Then the Pharisees went and plotted to entrap Jesus in what he said. So they sent their disciples to him, along with the Herodians, saying, "Teacher, we know you are sincere, and teach the way of God in accordance with truth, and show deference to no one, for you do not regard people with partiality. Tell us then what you think. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not?" But Jesus, aware of their malice, said, "Why are you putting me to the test, you hypocrites? Show me the coin used for the tax." And they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, "Whose head is this, and whose title?" They answered, "The emperor's." Then he said to them, "Give therefore to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's." When they heard this, they were amazed, and they left him and went away. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Of all the questions they put to Jesus, here's the one his challengers ask today. Should we pay our taxes, yes or no? Now, those in authority have already questioned his authority, essentially asking, "Who do you think you are?" And he doesn't answer them. As we already learned from conversations with his disciples, Jesus wants to know who they think he is. His true identity is something that everyone needs to figure out. So he doesn't answer and goes on his way. But now the interrogators are buzzing around his head like hornets. He has stirred up the hive, both in his elusiveness and in some of these ornery parables that we've been hearing this fall. So they swarm the Savior and come at him, "Stinger first, tell us about taxes, yes or no. What do you think?" Those of us with grown children remember the look on their faces, so excited to get a real job, and 2 weeks later, so ecstatic to get that first real paycheck. The envelope is opened, and there's a moment of silence. And the question comes, "Where's all the money? Why isn't it all here?" Welcome to adulthood, honey. Taxes are a part of life. Hey, Jesus, should we pay our taxes? It's a worthy question, if you have a choice about it. Most of us don't have a choice. In the attorney's conference room to sign my first mortgage, I wondered out loud, now if the bank owns my house for the next 30 years, shouldn't the bank pay the taxes? My good attorney smiled and said, "It doesn't work that way." He paused and said, "I wish it did." For us, maybe the better questions are these. Do we want teachers to be paid a living wage? Would you like public safety officers to be protected? Would you like to have straight roads without potholes? Well, we'll not get into that in Lackawanna County. The greater point was well made by Oliver Wendell Holmes, the Supreme Court Justice, who said, "Taxes are what we pay for civilized society." These days, we all need a healthy dose of civilization, don't you think? Here in the Gospel of Matthew, it's curious that Jesus has already been asked if he pays his taxes. That was back in chapter 17. The collectors asked if he paid the temple tax. The answer was yes, he does. But what was the temple tax? In that day, every Jewish male over the age of 20 was required to pay 2 days' wages every year to support the buildings and grounds of the Jerusalem temple. You couldn't worship there without also supporting that physical institution. And that tax was in addition to the 10% tithe required by the scriptures. And you'll be glad to know this is not what the Pharisees and the Herodians were asking about. No, it was assumed that every believer supported the upkeep of the temple and made their tithe to God. That was not the issue. No, they were asking about the other tax, the empire tax. The tax laid on their shoulders by Tiberius Caesar. He did not live in Jerusalem. He certainly didn't worship in their temple. He lived in Rome, where he had people worshiping him. He lived in an opulent palace and stationed his soldiers far off in Jerusalem to keep the Jewish citizens under his heavy foot. Tiberius was not one of the better Caesars in Roman history. He built good roads, but he was reviled for his corruption. To quote the Roman historian Tacitus, Tiberius was infamous for his cruelty and his veiled debaucheries. At the end, he plunged into every wickedness and disgrace, and with fear and shame being cast off, he simply indulged his own inclinations. And the Pharisees and the Herodians asked Jesus, "Are you going to pay your taxes to support that guy?" It's a good question. A really good question. It's such a good question that they think they have him up against the wall. On the one hand, if he pays the tax to Tiberius, he loses credibility with many of the people who are following him. For 25 years, they have begrudgingly paid taxes to the empire that occupied their villages and oppressed their lives. They protested the tax as an illegal act and a moral outrage. And if Jesus simply says, "Pay it," he could lose the people who love him. On the other hand, if Jesus says, "No, don't pay any taxes to Tiberius," one of the Herodians may whistle for a centurion to move in to grab this agitator and to get rid of him on their behalf. So they think they've got him. They grease their question with all the smarminess they can muster. "Good teacher, we know you're fair. We know you're impartial. We know you're wise. Yada, yada, yada." And as we know, he replies with a brilliant answer that sets them back on their heels. "Who's got a quarter?" he asks. "And then whose image is on that coin? Then give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar, give to God what belongs to God." And they are speechless. They have nothing to say. They stand frozen with their jaws open. And then they shuffle away. Now they should have known better than to wrestle with the Christ. That same imagination that created the parables we've been hearing is the same imagination that raises at least three important questions, questions still with us, questions that do not easily settle and are not easily dismissed. Here's the first question. Whose image is on the coin? That's the literal translation. Whose image? The word is icon. It's a loaded term. According to the ancient story, you remember this, when God made human people, God scooped up mud from the riverbank, shaped it, and blew holy breath into the nostrils. It came alive and it could breathe, because that's the Bible's view of when life begins, when we breathe. God said, "This is good, very, very good." And the Bible declares we are created in the icon of God, in the image. And this must never be tarnished. And that's why the Bible commands us, don't make any fake images, think icons. And if you do, don't bow before them. That's the second big commandment. So let me ask the obvious. What's a Pharisee doing within the precincts of the Jerusalem temple with a Roman coin in his pocket? For on the face of that coin is the icon of Tiberius Caesar, and around it is the inscription, Son of the Divine Augustus. Biblically speaking, it is a graven image, a small circular metallic idol. And there were money changers at the gate so that nobody would dare ever bring such a secular coin, a denarius, inside the temple court. But notice this. Jesus does not criticize the presence of that coin. Nor does he critique the mingling of sacred and secular. Now why? If he were a purist, someone so heavenly would have nothing to do with earth, nothing to do with something as tempting as money. We affirm he is the incarnate Son of God. He is the marriage of heaven and earth walking around on two legs. He has set aside all earthly, all privilege of heaven to live with us on earth. Jesus is the complete image of God. And a good part of his work is to restore God's image in us, which is a work very much still in progress. So that points to the second question. What belongs to Caesar? There are two answers. One, not as much as Caesar thinks. And two, more than Caesar realizes. I say this as a Presbyterian, for if Presbyterians know about anything, they know about government. They know a government is necessary for order and protection. A government is called to care for its people and cultivate their ability to flourish. And a government does not exist on pure oxygen. It needs funding to function and financial oversight to function responsibly. And the other thing we know is a government lives only by the voice of the people who are governed. Now, no government carries out these functions perfectly, because governments consist of imperfect people. Some of them are sufficiently imperfect to believe they are doing a better job than they actually are. And our spiritual tradition tells us why this is the case. Political authority creates its own blind spots. Power is easily corrupted, which is why Presbyterians have always insisted on a system of checks and balances so that power can be shared and authority can be held accountable. So what belongs to Caesar? The people, for one thing, and the common good, for another. Neither the people nor the common good are served by a government that ignores them. And a government that can be bought or sold by a few will never provide for the needs of the many. That was the crisis of the Roman Empire, which led to its inevitable collapse. And here the empire demands a tax from those who will never benefit from it. Here's the third question. What belongs to God? And the best answer is everything. Today we open with a line from the 24th Psalm, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof." Everything. If Jesus unites heaven and earth, there is no place that God cannot reach. There is no sphere of influence that can totally exclude God's influence. Theologian Stanley Hauerwas reminds us that the pronouncement of Jesus is often misunderstood. He says, we hear Jesus says, give to Caesar what belongs to Caesar and give to God what belongs to God. And we're tempted to think there are dual allegiances, one to Caesar and country and the other to God. Well, no. There is only one allegiance, and that is to God. When we serve our country, which we are all called to do, it is one expression of how we serve the one and only God to whom everything belongs. Caesar only exists by the grace of God. And should Caesar ever be replaced, that also happens by the grace of God. Now we know whose image is on the face of our coins, but whose image is on your face or mine? And whose image is on the face of friend or foe? It is the image of God. And as I look to you, I see a striking family resemblance. This is why we value one another. This is why we engage in God's world. This is why we're all going to vote, and why we work to improve human government. And this is why we kneel beside those in need, and why we care for one another. And it's also why we pay attention to what we do with our money. Jesus did not dismiss the question about taxes because he knows every single day we have to make choices. He didn't spiritualize the matter of money because he knows money buys bread. And as much as he knows the love of money can tempt us to evil deeds, he knows that money can also empower good works. Christ entrusts us with the stewardship of our choices. He calls us to bear the image of God in all that we do, all that we give, and all that we love. Now, this is hard work. It's grown-up work. Just as we noticed the shock on the kid's face when she learns taxes are deducted from that first paycheck, so we acknowledge our lives are full of responsibilities. Some responsibilities come as a surprise. Others are welcomed joyfully. Still others shake us from our complacency by their demands. And beneath it all is a question you can answer. It is the question, I think, that never goes away. In case you forgot the question, here it is again. What belongs to God? I think you know the answer.